Welcome to Pints with Treebeard. My name is Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho. And today, as most days, I am joined by Mr. Jameson Winter, a man who has probably saved my life on at least one occasion. Jameson, what else do you want the people to know about you?
I was just trying to think if that's true or not. I bet it is. Yeah, I bet it is. My name is Jameson Winter, and I'm the dean of the upper school at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee. And yes, I probably have saved your life on one occasion, maybe more. So today, what are we talking about, Josh?
So this is a Dadcraft episode. We're going to talk about specifically, well, in the Dadcraft episodes, we tend to focus on one particular aspect of being a dad and think about it carefully and critically so that we can be faithful in our callings as husbands and fathers, but particularly in the practical, the nitty-gritty. So today's topic is affectionately titled Around the Table, and we're going to be looking at mostly family dinners, right? So when you all are gathered for a meal, usually in the evening, though theoretically we could also talk about family breakfasts or family lunches for that matter, but probably we'll stick to family dinners. So we're going to try to consider this, like, what is it? Is it more than just the sum of its parts? Is it more than just you're all sitting around a, you know, rectangular piece of wood and you all are putting food in your mouths? Or is it more than that? And if it is more, how do we understand that? And then we're going to think, you know, carefully about the different ways that a father can use that around the table time to cause his household to flourish. I don't know. Maybe, Jameson, I'd be interested, just you personally, what were family dinners like for you growing up? Like, what was that like?
It's hard to remember all of it because it changed several times for us. And we weren't one of those families that sat down to dinner every night, at least not for the whole time that I was at home. And I'm the youngest. And so I got to see that change more maybe than my older siblings, who kind of, you know, my oldest sister's leaving for school and I'm still very young, so things looked more similar for her throughout. But I got to see the development of, okay, as I'm like the last one standing, so to speak, back home for 4 years, my youngest sister's 4 years older than me. What did dinner look like then? Well, then it was really not like family dinner altogether like it used to be when we were all little kids. So I will say for the bulk of my childhood, maybe the first two-thirds or so, we were regularly, maybe not every night, but regularly sitting around the dinner table eating together. And I didn't think about it in these terms then. And so looking back, it's hard to have like a program that was imposed on it or to see if there was any intentional structure from my parents, because they certainly didn't frame it that way where we knew there was a structure to dinner. But there very well could have been things that they were intentionally asking or talking about or bringing up that they just didn't clue us into. That, you know, maybe behind the scenes, they're saying, we want to talk about these kinds of things or ask these kinds of questions, but not explicitly saying, okay, kids, dinner is a time when you ask these questions to your kids. So what do I remember? I think just kind of run-of-the-mill, normal conversation, you know, talking about the day, breaking down how things went, talking to dad about work, and when my mom was working, talking to her about how things went for her day, or, you know, the two of them would talk about things that were coming up and things that we were planning as a family. You get to the point, at least this is my experience, right? You get to the point where as kids, you're all engaged in conversation enough that we were one of those families where there were two or three conversations happening at once with six people, and you're actually jumping in and out of different conversations the whole time. And everybody's not like that. And I didn't know that until I met other people, but particularly my wife and her family are not like that. And so it was kind of a culture adjustment, eating dinner with them versus eating dinner with my family. Now it's just like a force multiplier because we're all married with kids. And so when we sit around the 16-foot table, it's like 13 conversations going on at once and you're jumping in and out of them. So that was the kind of aroma, I would say, very informal, not like a rigid liturgy or anything like that. We would pray before the meal, talk about the day, talk about what we were interested in, talk about movies or books that we were reading or something like that. And then we would at some point be dismissed and excused to start clean up and go about our day.
Yeah, I thought that I could remember that big 16-foot table. You built that with your dad on a break, right?
Yeah, so I think it was our freshman year. So growing up, it was just, you know, the four of us kids, and we could all fit around a normal size dinner table, like 6 feet, okay, two kids on each side on the benches and mom and dad at either end. And so as they started getting married and having kids, my mom said when we were on Thanksgiving break, I think our freshman year, oh, you know, I've always wanted a table where I could sit with all my grandkids. And I was like, well, I'll build you a table, not having done that before, but just thinking, I bet I could do that. And so, yeah, my dad and I built a 16-foot table in 3 days and finished it literally. We didn't stain it. He did that later, but we literally finished it and had it ready like an hour before Thanksgiving dinner, which means the girls could come and set the table, put out decorations, put out a tablecloth and all the, you know, all the food and everything. And it was awesome because it was wide enough that you could actually have the food running in the middle of the table if you wanted to, and then you still have plenty of room to eat. So sometimes we would do that. Sometimes we'd have decorations running down the middle of the table because that's something that people do. I was never any part of that, but it always looked amazing. It was incredible. So yeah, we did that. Now they've moved. They didn't take that table with them, but they did buy a table that would work the same way essentially, so we can still do that at their new house.
That's great. Yeah, that's a lovely. The way you describe that is a lovely example of, you know, the forming and filling we've talked about before. That, you know, the men form the world and the ladies fill it with lots of lovely things. That's great. Yeah, for us growing up, there were various phases. You're the youngest, I'm the oldest. So you know, the way I experienced family dinners was probably different than the way my younger siblings did. There were various phases. You know, there was a phase early on, when we were all pretty young, where we went through kind of a strange, I confess now that it's rather strange, like we watched movies during dinner a lot, and that didn't seem weird at the time, feels kind of weird now, but maybe just, you know, five little kids and my parents needed something to get us through, but we did that a lot. Then kind of in my middle school years, dinners were normal, kind of like you're describing, informal, run-of-the-mill, sit down, eat your food, talk about the day, that sort of thing. In early high school, we started, we didn't really play sports growing up until we found the YMCA swim team, and that we could all practice at the same time. We all went to the same place. It was easy, but it happened that the practices ran from 6 to 8, and so you don't want to eat a lot before you go swim, and then that's the dinner hour. So we would we would all come home from practice at 8, 8:30, and be all starving. And so we would have these like big, kind of impromptu, but very, you know, familial meals in the evenings after swim practice. But probably when I think about family dinners, the phase of life that I remember most keenly was, did you guys do Awana? Do you know Awana?
Yep.
Okay. Our church had a big Awana program, and our family was heavily involved. So my dad was the, you know, TNT director, the third and fourth graders. I was the games guy. You know, my siblings, we all did various, we served and led in various ways. So that was Wednesday nights. And then we would always struggle to have a dinner beforehand. So again, we would come home 8:30-ish, and we would all have a dinner together late into the night. And that was where we would talk and share anecdotes. So those times I remember being particularly formative. Okay, kind of with that as background, I'd like us to consider what is the family dinner, and you know why ought it to play a key role in a family's life? Why does it inevitably play a part in a family's life? So I've just got a couple of kind of bullet points to bounce off you, or for us to consider together. So one is that the family is built around this covenant, right? The family, the household, is a thing. It's formed on the bedrock of the marriage covenant, but then the children are added to it. You know, the father is the head, and then his wife and children are, you know, represented by him. But they are bound together. They're more than the sum of the parts. It's not just a coalition of individuals, but it is a entity. And In the providence of God, the way he has set up the world is such that we gather around meals. He has made us to be creatures that have to eat three times a day, give or take. And so we gather around food, which is, you know, a sign of our creaturely existence. We're dependent upon God for our sustenance, for our life. And we do that together. We all come and partake of the stuff of life together. So in a very real way, the family dinner is a renewal of covenant. We are bound in covenant together, one with another, and we renew that, not dissimilar to how we renew covenant with the Lord on Sunday mornings, or any sort of other covenant that has some sort of ritual that reminds everyone that it's still in effect, that renews it again. So thoughts on that dinner as a family dinner as covenant renewal.
Well, this is something that has just been on my mind really maybe since this summer, and I've been thinking about it more in these terms, and was part of my excitement for this episode, which is just to hash some of this out with you, because I've asked you at least once before what you thought about this idea, and it wasn't in person, so we didn't go back and forth on it very much, but essentially coming to see what you've said, which is that we have this covenant community, and we ought to treat this meal, maybe dinner in particular, but meals in general around the table that we share, as a form of covenant renewal, even if it's not the same kind of thing in exactly the same ways as the Lord's table. He's given us this pattern to imitate. And it's not, by the way, just communion. This was always the pattern with covenants that we see in the scriptures, that you come and you share a meal together after you've bound yourself in covenant, and you celebrate the loyalty and the bonds of that covenant. So you see again and again and again people making covenants and sitting down to a meal together. And they're eating oftentimes part of a sacrifice that's part of that covenant. And so there's this beautiful symbolism, and there's this beautiful maybe kind of vocabulary to covenant making and covenant ritual, covenant renewal that we get from the scriptures. And I think it behooves us to maybe dig a little deeper on that and see, okay, how can we apply this in our homes and what can we draw? So I think it's a beautiful idea and meaningful. I've not read much or heard much talk about it though. And so I'm kind of thinking through these things live. So just as an example, one of the things that we do is to sing the doxology before our meals. And that actually started as a practice before I fully thought out what it is that we're doing. But I wanted innately, I think, to call my children and our family as a whole into an attitude of thanksgiving and celebration by singing the doxology. So praise God from whom all blessings flow. What are we doing before a meal when we pray? Well, first and foremost, we're thanking God for this food. Right, Jesus gives thanks for the bread, and then he breaks it and multiplies it and gives it to the 5,000. Right, and he thanks God and he blesses it. He gives thanks at the Last Supper and then passes it around. Right, so we're coming to God in a spirit of gratitude as a covenant community, and that's true in the church. It's also true at the dinner table for us. We are a covenant community, not the new covenant community, but we are a covenant community within our marriage and our family. And so we are coming to God as such, giving him thanks and ordering this time around the dinner table towards him, towards his glory. And that doesn't mean that we sit here woodenly reciting psalms and, you know, practicing our catechism questions the whole time, and like there's no laughter and it's very somber. That sounds like death, actually. That's not celebration in the way that it should be. You can include those things, and we do include some of those things, but that's an overly kind of formal and rigid approach to the dinner table. So I think there's maybe a starting point, is that I want, if we think about this liturgically, I want to call my children and my wife and myself into a spirit of gratitude to God for the meal itself, but then also everything that that means, which preeminently is the unity that we have as a family around the meal, the unity that we have with one another by the grace of God. And every time we gather together to eat together, we're celebrating that because we're acknowledging that we belong together in a unique way, and we don't gather with other people to eat dinner, at least not regularly. We'll have them over, we'll go to someone's house, but that's an odd circumstance in the sense that it's not repeated daily. But daily, we're coming back together to do this. And so that's maybe a foundation. I could say more, but I'm curious what your thoughts are in response to that kind of calling into the fellowship meal and then proceeding in fellowship together.
Yeah, you're hitting on the parallels between the Lord's Day worship service and the family dinner. And those are not the same thing. Those are not... And one is not a subset of the other. It's not like family dinner is a subset or a part of Lord's Day worship, but they are analogous. And I would almost say that there is a, I think I would definitely say, that there is a an overflow of from the Lord's Day worship to family dinners. And we'll talk more about this later, I think, but... The central feast of the Christian life is the Lord's Supper, and that provides the basis for all of our feasting, right? And to varying degrees, family dinner is a feast. It is a coming together for the purpose of celebrating over food. And so you can draw a line back from our eating together. This meal, you know, this macaroni and cheese, right? You can draw the line back to the wine and bread of the Lord's Supper, that because we have peace with God, we have peace with one another. Because God has given us himself, he also has given us all good things. Because we have peace with one another, we can partake together. Because we have this gift of God given to us, we receive it with gratitude, right? And all of that is echoed, all of that is true as well. It is analogously true, but I want to say there's some thread of substance between the two, such that if we were not invited to the Lord's table on Sunday morning, our feasting around our own tables would be dust and ashes. And you could say, well, what if non-Christians have happy times around their tables too? And I'd say, yes, because somewhere, right? Because Christ died and rose again, ascended on high, and gave gifts to men. And that provided the principle by which, and that even the pagans are partaking of Christ in a way, that they are partaking of the blessings of God, even though they deny him, right? And that'll be to their, they'll be judged for it in the last day, right? Because they did not give thanks. But all of our feasting ties back to the fact that Christ gave himself in the Lord's Supper.
And on that note, even with this idea, like you're saying, that people might say, well, pagans have family dinners. Yes, okay, pagans also have marriages that at times they're faithful to, sometimes for the entire marriage. Pagans also love one another in some certain and distinct ways. But all of that is borrowed from God, right? All of that is, I think, another version of the kind of thing you're saying, which is they're taking this blessing that God has given generally to mankind, but particularly to Christians, and particularly he has given Christians the eyes to see it for what it is and understand it, and then bless him with it, and then express gratitude to him with it. So you could say a pagan man and woman, and you should say a pagan man and woman, are married not only in the eyes of the state, but in the eyes of God. That's true. It's a clear biblical principle. And you can also say that the Christian is the only one who can do that truthfully in a way that reflects what God intended it to reflect, because they understand the man is playing the role of Christ and the bride is playing the role of the church in this relationship. And there's a metaphor here that's going on, that's being lived out in front of everyone. Pagans are participating in that, but they're telling lies about it oftentimes. Not all the time, even, you know, if you have a husband who lays down his life for his wife and that sort of thing, he can do that in part, although he's not going to be washing her with the water of the word and presenting her to God in that way. So you can say that of the dinner table as well, that there's a deeper and richer sense of fellowship that Christians can share in their families and with other families when you invite someone over for dinner, because you've been united not only around the physical thing, the table, in the covenant of marriage and your family, which you share, but also you've been connected to one another and restored to one another in a kind of lateral sense spiritually. You're not just reconciled with God, you're reconciled with one another. And that's a key that I think you could overlook, and you could think those realities don't touch the dinner table, but they really, really do. If you're reconciled with your brother or your sister in Christ, if you're reconciled with your children in Christ, that goes so far beyond just the normal, natural relationships that you have with children when you're a pagan family, right? Even if you love one another well, you're going to get such a deeper, richer communion with one another through Christ.
Yeah, that's right. And that also touches upon how important it is to be in fellowship with your children, with your wife. You know, if you are coming to your dinner table with, you know, crackling, you know, jealousies and bitternesses and unconfessed sins and all of that, that's not the same thing as coming to the Lord's table with unconfessed sin, but it is analogous to it.
And I would say it is also, it is sin. And so you are, it's analogous, but it's also serious in the same kind of way, because you're walking in unrepentant sin, or someone is walking in unrepentant sin, even if it's your two kids, and you're not addressing it. And we have to understand, I mean, there are times that we've had to do this, either with Megan and I having to work through something quickly right before we sit down to dinner, and we say, it's worth delaying dinner 2 or 3 minutes to get back in fellowship very quickly in the kitchen while the kids are waiting, than it is to sit down and be angsty and bitter and prickly at dinner, because that's not going to bless anyone. And that's actually probably going to lead them into further temptation themselves, or lead us into further temptation. Same thing for disciplining a kid, right? If Levi and Ezra are just picking at each other and you know, being wicked towards one another, we're not doing them favors by just saying, okay, stop and just sit down to dinner, and we're not going to address the sin that just happened, and we'll get past the situation. That's not helping them. What's helping them is to say, no, we're going to go and administer godly discipline and restore fellowship, and you will repent and you'll forgive one another. And then we'll sit down and eat 5 minutes later. And that's okay. And it's okay if we end up being a little bit late to something that we're going to after dinner, because fellowship was restored and we enjoyed this meal together properly, rather than walking in disunity, which is lying about what it is that we're doing by sharing a meal.
That's right. That's right. Right. It's the honesty aspect, right? Like a husband who mistreats his wife is lying about Christ, right? Similarly, a father who allows there to be division at his table is, in some sense, at least a Christian father, he's lying about the unity of the people of God,
and the unity of the family specifically too.
Good, good. At the risk of indulging in what Pastor Wilson sometimes calls a Zen Presbyterianism, I've been thinking about another aspect, and that is the nature of place and the nature of space. I'm doing some reading that maybe we'll talk about later, and it has to do with different ways of thinking about space itself. Is space a container that other things are in, or is space a thing that is affected and created by the things that are in it, right? Or that it is around, right? And this is has massive implications for different conceptions of the cosmos. You know, in the Enlightenment era, the receptacle nature of space was dominant, but then in modern physics, there's now this more dynamic sense that space itself is affected by the things that are in it. Okay, so I'm playing with some of these thoughts, but where that plays out here is, if you think of space as not just a receptacle, but if you think of space as something that is affected by the things, you know, so I have my water bottle on the table, and that's not just on the table, but it's not just in space, but it is affecting the space, right? In a real sense, then, I think we can and ought to think about place as a thing that is created by the things and people that are in it. And I think that sounds kind of strange, but I think it's actually just the most common thing in the world, right? The room is defined by the things that are in it. It's not defined by its physical location as, you know, coordinates in space. It's defined by what is in it. It's defined by what it's used for, right? And so in a real way, we make places when people come together, and a place is created by the interactions between the people. So I think this is, again, most potently seen in Lord's Day worship, that when the people of God come into that place, they are truly, because of the relations between themselves, but more because of the work of the Spirit, relating, uniting them to Christ and to one another, that they are actually brought into the presence of God. And it's not like they're being physically elevated, voop, 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 right? But actually a space is being created. Like, there, God comes to meet with them, and now that space is a space that is defined by the interactions of God and his people. I think the same thing is true around the dinner table, that you are actually creating in space and time a place that is not defined by the rectangular piece of wood that you're all sitting around, but is actually, is far more than the sum of its parts, that the place itself is, I don't know, hallowed in a sense. It is different from anything else. It, and you are making it by gathering your people around it in that time and in that way.
In that sense, I love this. And in that sense, you could say it's made holy. In the most literal sense of the word, it's set apart for a purpose, which is dinner fellowship, right? And as Christians, it's kind of a double usage of the word, because we are both consecrating it to God for worship, because our life is a living sacrifice and all of life is a form of worship. But it's also, just at a more basic level, being consecrated unto the purpose that the space and the time is being given. And so I love that as a way of conceiving of what's happening, because you're essentially saying, what makes dinner time dinner time? It's not just the table and the plates with food. It's actually, those are accidental properties in some sense of dinner time. The true essence of the dinner table is the fellowship that comes from sitting around the table and talking with one another. Again, however you do that in your family, whether you go through catechisms or read a book or read part of the Bible or pray together or share about your day or whatever the trappings are, again, that you put into it and into that time with your family, those are maybe neither here nor there to some extent, right? There are maybe some things that should characterize a dinner and some things that shouldn't characterize a dinner with your family, but there's a lot of latitude. What you're really creating is this, like you said, this covenant renewal space, this place for us to come as a family, as a covenant community, and to be bound further together and to be reunited together if there has been any frustration or friction, right? That, you know, this sibling hit me in the face earlier today and I'm still feeling some type of way about that. I've forgiven them, but, you know, I'm working through it and it's hard. Now we can sit down and laugh and chortle deeply at the two-year-old's silly story that he's making up that makes no sense to anyone. And you love one another because of that. You enter into deeper love and fellowship because you've created this space for that to happen. So anyway, maybe that is a little too woo-woo Presbyterianism, or I would say woo-woo Baptist theology. I'm a big proponent of not letting you guys have all the good theology, all the good doctrine.
We can share. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. And I think that it is tempting, incredibly tempting for a father, and I think this will transition us nicely to talking about particulars, but it's incredibly tempting for fathers to feel like dinner time is a thing that he just is along for the ride for. Like, it's just, we're just sliding through. I'm on the bus is going from here to there. I look out the window and there's a pretty field and that's dinner time, right? We're going through it. It's going to happen whether I'm involved or not. It just is what it is. And there you go. But no, I say the father has a particular duty to draw, to build this space in, or this rather, to build this place in space and time that will go away when the family departs. Like, it's a thing that he's almost calling into existence. He's not calling it, he's sort of officiating at it, right? But he can do so well or poorly. But it's not the fact, it's not the case that the thing is just sliding along and he's just along for the ride. No, he's an architect building something, and he can do so in a way that glorifies God and causes his people to flourish, or he cannot.
So on that note, let's maybe transition to thinking about some specifics, some particulars, because I think we have a little bit of the vision of what it is that we're trying to design, what it is that we're trying to build. And if the goal, succinctly put, is deeper fellowship and love within the covenant body of your family, or any others who happen to be guests in your home, drawing them into that, right? The goal is, as a father, you're setting the tone to draw your wife and kids deeper into this covenant bond at the dinner table, at the covenant meal, you could say. Then what are some of the particulars that need to accompany this? So I do think, for instance, there needs to be some kind of calling into this, you could say, ceremony. Again, I think that's an analogous word we could use to tie it back to the Lord's Day worship, but it's also not that formal typically. And so I don't want to use ceremony and people hear that and think something rigid or something where you have to sit with your shoulders back like this and hands perfectly placed on the table and all of these kinds of like protocol sorts of things, because frankly, I just don't think that that's how you should have dinner with little kids. Maybe occasionally, like there might be a nice dinner that you go to or whatever, teach them those things, but good luck, right? And sit loose in the saddle if you try that.
send me a postcard.
That's right. Yeah. Take a picture because nobody will believe it. So the formality aspect is not an essential part of it, although it might be more formal when it's tied to a special event like a birthday, right? You might do something special and more formal on a birthday dinner for a kid or for you or your wife. What are some other aspects, though? What are some practical things that you think should, or on the other hand, should not be part of dinner?
Yeah. So one thing that I wanted to bring up that I slipped my mind before is the aspect of hospitality. Like, how does inviting people over, how does that change things? And I think it is directly related to this. When you invite another family or other people over to your house for a meal, you're inviting them into that space that you have already made. So hospitality ought to be an overflow of what is already there. It's not something... Now, of course, the people you invite will inevitably affect it as well, of course, but it should be here. We have this space that we have made, and there's room for you. Come in. Right. Regarding particulars, what should and should not happen at the dinner table, I don't want to bind anyone's conscience. I think that you're exactly right in that there is great latitude in what should and what is possible. So I think all I can do is kind of say what we've done in the past and what we do now, and it'll look different for different families, but some elements that should always be there. There should always be prayer. We ought to, that's non-negotiable. So we should be thanking the Lord for the gifts of his bounty, right? For what he has provided for our life and our sustenance. And I think it's particularly fitting for the father to offer that prayer at the beginning of the meal. I'm also kind of experimenting, as Benaiah is now 8, I'm kind of experimenting with letting him pray at the meal. And I think that that's a good thing as well. So I'll ask him to offer the prayer. If any other children want to pray, I will always let them in addition, right? So I'm always happy to say, and you may also pray, right? We're happy to pray more. But I think that there's a fatherly, masculine, initiating aspect to the prayer. And then, obviously, there should be food, right? And there's festal food and more everyday food. And it's the father's job to lead the family in rejoicing in whatever there is. Days are full, money is tight. Sometimes it's rice and beans. And so it's the father's job to lead the family in delighting in, praising, giving thanks for the mother's, is for his wife's faithful service there. I love your beginning with the doxology. There ought to be song at your tables. That's just got to be. We typically will sing at the end, except for on our Sabbath dinner, where we will sing at the beginning. But that's neither here nor there. And then there ought to be just robust conversation, and it's an opportunity for everyone to talk, and for again the father to make sure that everyone is being heard and directing. So I'll try to ask, you know, once we're kind of everything served and everything's going, I will try to find the child that's not been heard from and attend to them, usually Salem, and ask her, like, Salem, please tell me about your day. Like, what's a joy or a sorrow from your day today?
And to continue that, I will also, you can do that, maybe I was going to say well and poorly, but you can do that well and you can do it less well, because doing that at all is good, right? Asking your specific children specific questions is good. But one of the things I noticed and that I try to do is typically I'll start with Ezra, because I know that he will just want to say whatever Levi said again, because Levi's older. And so they're at that age. And so I want to hear from Ezra what's actually on his mind or heart. And I also want to hear from Levi, but I know that Levi's not going to be bound to what Ezra said. He'll say something different if he thinks something different. And if he doesn't think something different, he'll say the same thing too. And that's great. Typically at our stage, that looks like, you know, Ezra, tell me what your favorite thing you did today was, you know, something like that. And they get to talk about what they played. And then there might be a, you know, further questions about how did you play that? Or what was that like? Or which character were you pretending to be from Robin Hood or whatever they were doing? And that's just great. And you don't want, I think as a father, the other temptation can be like, this is all kind of silly and does it really matter? And like, I already heard about this from my wife anyway, and I got a chuckle out of it then, but do I need to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak? Like, do I need to hear about my kids playing 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea from them when I already heard about that from my wife? And the answer is yes, I do. And I should ask them about that, because that shows them that I'm interested in them and I want to hear them and hear what they have to say. Like you said, you don't want somebody just sitting there quietly, not talking. And again, that might change with seasons or with age of your kids, or if you have guests over, right? The kids are maybe going to be talking less. But even then, I would say the temptation can be when you have guests over for the adults to talk and the kids don't get to talk. And I just think you need to, as a father, take the responsibility to cut against that and to bring them into conversation, including bringing them into conversation with your guests. And if you have great guests, they'll do that too, right? They're good at that. They'll ask questions of your kids and engage at their level some too.
No, this is huge. Kelsey and I talk about this all the time. We want our children to love one another. Duh. We want our children to be friends. We want our children to just have the best times together. And we want that to continue forever and ever. How do we do that? And I'm convinced that maybe the main way, other than taking them to church every Sunday and teaching them to confess their sins and honor their God, second to that, the way that you foster love amongst your children is you, as the father and also as the mother, just delight in your kids in front of your other kids. Right. And just be pleased as punch with everything about them and shower them with love and affection and attention. And that makes all the other kids go, whoa, huh? The person that I think is coolest in the world, right? The most awesome person I know thinks that my little brother is worthy of love and attention. Wow. That just must be true. Right. And I think that's a huge opportunity we have at the dinner table. For me, well, I'm tempted to be tired or annoyed or go on. And there is a place for saying, thank you, that is enough. We are now going to, right? Because some of my children will just talk. But for me to give my love, attention, delight, appreciation to one child, first of all, just blesses them and it's like sunshine on their little souls. But also, huge secondary benefit is that it teaches the rest of the children how to think about that child. And that's just gold.
And I think you can see this very naturally in certain aspects of your kids. When you have a baby, it doesn't really matter. It shouldn't matter if things are going well, I should say, it won't matter who the kid is, what their personality is or whatever. They're going to love their baby brother or sister. They're going to love giving them hugs, and they're going to say, oh, look at that cute face that she made. And now she's spitting when she does her tongue like this, and that's silly, and drool is getting everywhere, and, you know, that sort of thing. And you have to kind of temper that love sometimes because they have to recognize this is a baby. You can't do that. I'm sorry. You're going to hurt them. You need to stop. But that's very natural. But I love the way that you put it and the emphasis that you put on it, because it is so important not to just leave it there, but to actually draw your children into that and help them to celebrate one another and delight in one another. I think this is also important in how your kids play with each other. And we can talk more about this another time maybe, but it's the same kind of thing there, where you want your kids to celebrate the successes of their siblings, and you want them to be proud of their siblings when their siblings do something. So when a kid does something brave, or when a kid is being tough, don't just tell them, oh, that was very brave, I'm so proud of you. Draw your kids into that and say, hey, look at how Ezra's being brave. Look at how Levi's being brave. Aren't you proud of him? Aren't you proud of your brother, or aren't you proud of your sister for being tough? Isn't that great? And help them learn how to praise one another well. And tying that back to something you said earlier, you should also be doing that for your wife's sake, right? Teaching them how to praise your wife, teaching them how to praise their mom, which starts again at the dinner table, praising her for the food and pointing out, there's this kind of game that I play with the boys where I'll think Megan for the food and the work that she's put into it. And sometimes they'll follow suit and they get the cue, and sometimes they don't. And so I'll wait till Megan's looking away and she notices, not all the time, but I know that she always knows it's happened, even if she didn't see it, where I'll point to them and I'll mouth like, say thank you. I was about to mouth it to you and nobody can hear me, or see me. So I'll mouth to them something like, say thank you. And they'll just go, thank you, Mama, for this food. It's so delicious, or whatever. And we teach them to say that even when it's not their favorite thing, because they're recognizing something true, even if it's not their favorite thing, which is that they are grateful. They are thankful to have food that they can eat, even if they would rather eat something else. And it's a blessing to them to have a plate full, so full that they won't eat it all. And that's a good thing to celebrate and to be grateful for.
Yeah, that's right. Just kind of a couple of other things that I think we've established what this is and what it can be. These are other things that you can use the family dinner for that I think are great. So we've got three kids in school now, and I learned this from Matt Whitling, who is the superintendent of Logos, and he suggested this, and a thing that I listened to a while back, and I just said, that's great, I'm doing that. And that is, everything that the child got back from school that day goes at my spot at the dinner table. And they just, there's a pile of stuff right there at my spot. And usually, either right after we've started eating or right before when Kelsey's bringing stuff to the table, I will go through everything that every child got back that day. And we will praise the successes and we'll comment upon the deficiencies, and we'll just kind of, that serves as, first of all, me having a finger on the pulse of every child, but also me being able to praise their successes. And that's just, it's great, and be able to praise each other. And I'll work from youngest to oldest, right? So we'll do Salem stuff first. And, you know, she traced E's. Yes! Right? And then we'll go to Rosie, who's, you know, doing math facts. And then Benaya, who's, you know, writing paragraphs in cursive. And okay, and we're going through all of that together. And sometimes that means my food's cold, but that's okay.
That's such a great idea. And we're not there yet. We're maybe getting there though, because they're doing some stuff at home with Megan. They're drawing pictures. They're starting to write words, or at least Levi is. Ezra's trying to trace letters because Levi's doing it. And so it's a little harder for him as a 2-year-old, but he's getting there. And so it makes me want to try to start something like that, just to kind of prepare for that practice, because they do have these projects that they work on at home, and they want to show me those. And typically they're showing me those before dinner even starts. But if they haven't, right, something that they could do is bring them to the table. I love that idea. And then you get to look at it and talk about, what did you draw? What are each of these things? Show me in a way that's very intentional and directed, And that's also bringing it before the rest of the family, because little kids, even though it's not a big deal to us, it's a big deal to them. Like Levi last night after prayer, when he was coming out of the room with all the kids, he ran up to me and he has this picture of Moses at the burning bush that he was coloring on. And on the back, he said, "Dada, I wrote my name." And sure enough, there's Levi, right? And he's just learned to do that recently. So I was like, "Yes, I'm so proud of you. That's awesome." And being able to do something like that at the dinner table, I think, is a great way to foster, like we've been talking about, not just that you are delighting in your children, but you're showing them this is praiseworthy in your siblings, and you should be praising this. You should be delighting in it with them, which is just great. That's awesome. One of the avenues that I wanted to maybe go down a little bit also is just some things to avoid, and not like subject matters or I guess maybe practices you could say to avoid, but just things that distract or pull away from what it is that we're trying to cultivate. So the first thing, and you can set your own rules here on what exactly you do or where exactly you draw lines, but like the dinner table shouldn't be a time for people to be in their own phones or devices or things like that, right? That's antithetical to what we're trying to create. And so that probably means for most of us who lack the self-control, if a phone call starts coming through, just put your phone in another room. And that's usually what I do. Sometimes I'll forget that it's in my pocket, but it's not something that you have to obsess over in that sense. But it is something that comes in between you and your family, even if you're just looking and checking and saying, who's calling me, right? Or who sent me this text? If you get 5 texts throughout dinner, you might not even respond to them, which, like, if you are, okay, there's its own problem. But you might not even respond to them. But still, the constant kind of interruption of the flow is subtly, but truthfully teaching your kids that there's this thing that's more important right now than our table fellowship with one another. And that's just not the case. I would say there are emergencies, things you might need to pick up the phone for occasionally and interrupt a dinner for. But in that case, again, you can just turn your phone up where you can hear it from the other room. And then if it's actually ringing, sure, like go see who's calling if you need to. But that gives the kids something clear and visual where you leave the room and come back and they recognize there's something else he's going to check on, but he'll be right back unless there's something seriously wrong, right? And so that's one thing.
And in that sense, it's honest. Like one of the problems with the phone at the table is the dishonesty. You're pretending to be there when you're not. But if you have to leave, at least you're being honest. You're saying like, yeah, I am no longer with you, but I will be back.
Yes, and it's a clear visual indication to your kids, even from an early age, that that's what's happening. And that's just so important. Because look, we had a landline, right, growing up. So if somebody called, my dad was a chaplain at the hospital. Somebody may have just died. He might have to leave dinner and go to the hospital. And that's okay. That kind of thing can interrupt dinner. But what he's not doing is texting his buddies or calling his buddies to talk about football. Right. And say, hey, did you see the Alabama game? That was crazy. Right. This is family dinner time. It's about it. We might talk about the Alabama game because we all watched it together, but we're going to do that together. We're not going to be pulled different directions. So that's one that I think is pretty big. I've heard that from others as well, just that it's such a helpful practice. And it's certainly been the case for us. You just don't want to send those kinds of mixed signals to your kids. And it just shows them to be invested, that you're invested in this time, so they want to be invested in this time. Something that's maybe, like, that one's less of a temptation for us. It's just always been our practice, I think, not to do that at the dinner table because we both come from families that valued family dinner, and so it wasn't something cutting against the grain for either of us. But one similar kind of category of thing that I've had to be careful about and that Megan has been helpful in showing me, hey, you do this sometimes, and I think it's bringing in the same sort of issue as the phone thing, maybe just to a lesser degree, which is, you know, getting up early before I've dismissed everyone to start work on dishes or anything like that. Just checking on things like, oh, really quick, let me go and check this or check that. That's not pressing. It's not like necessary, strictly speaking. Even if I need to make sure I don't forget it, just jot a note down so that I read it after dinner and go and check on something for work or another pressing thing that I forgot about, doing before dinner. So you can, you can make a note of those things, but getting up to do them or getting up to put your dishes in the dishwasher, like I've just started waiting because I recognize I am actually interrupting the kind of fellowship that I'm trying to create. And it's counterproductive, really. And then we all can take our dishes at the same time and they still get done. It's not like it's any better for me to have done it and then come back and sit down at an empty place, right? The dish wasn't in the way. So in that sense, just waiting on things that are not necessary.
Yeah, and I think that's a really nice feature of having an ending ritual, something that we always do at the end of the meal, and that signals the end of the meal is really nice. So for us, we'll sing at the end, right? So we will usually read a Bible story. We talked about this when we talked about family worship way back when, but we will usually read from our Bible story book or from you know an actual chapter of the scriptures, and then we'll sing together, and then we'll pray, and that's the end of the meal. And so once we've done that, then everyone knows that we're now moving on to the next thing all together. And I think that's really nice.
That's great. And something that I want to think about how we can do something to conclude the meal together, because it's something that I've maybe recognized innately was missing without being able to put my finger on it. And this is part of what we even talked about a while back, which is just I'm trying to find ways to not formalize dinner, but create a legitimate liturgy to the meal and to the process. And so you come into it all at once in a very certain way, a particular way. You talk about particular things and try to make a point to hit each kid with some questions and get them talking and engaged. And you know, you joke around, you're silly, you're eating your food, obviously, getting your kids to eat your food, or not your food, hopefully not your food. You're getting your kids to eat their food. They need to start there. And if they could just do that, it would be great.
On that note, real fast, when we're talking about things to avoid, we've made a big deal of avoiding all food fussiness, that you eat what's set in front of you. And that's just big. And I think that that serves two functions. One, that's just right and fitting for the thing that the dinner table gathering is. It is a time of gratitude. It is a time of receptivity. It is a time to be communal, not to express one's own individuality. It's a time to be joining in the corporate thing. But also, I just find it an extremely practical place to fight discipline battles in willfulness in a child, because they really want to eat. And you're fighting with the grain as opposed to against the grain. So we'll have two or three battles running in the family at a time. Like, so-and-so struggles with this, and so-and-so struggles with that. And when those come up, we deal with them. And that can make dinner time unpleasant. And that's unfortunate. But it just is the way it is. And I think that it's valuable for those two reasons. So all food fussiness is to be clobbered.
Yes, and it's something that gets better the more you do it. If you're consistent with it, it's not that you will never have to fight those battles, but they will come up far less frequently if you are consistently disciplining. And if children know that if I complain about this and I don't eat it, or if I ask for something else incessantly and won't just accept that I'm not getting something else, I'll get discipline. Like, we'll go and leave the table. We're breaking fellowship. I'm going to get a spanking. I'm going to repent. I'm going to be restored, but I am going to come back to the table and the food's still going to be there. And that's what I'm going to eat if I eat anything. Yeah, I think it's essential. Also, just for their sake, to recognize that this is something that you don't just do here, but you will be expected to do when you go to someone else's home. Like, you accept what they give you even when you don't like it, because you like that they gave it to you. You're appreciative that they gave it to you, even if you would never choose this in a million years.
As parents are thinking about, like, boy, I don't want to have to fight this battle now, think how much less you will want to fight it at grandma's house, or think how much less you will want to fight it at, you know, when your pastor has you over for dinner and your child then can't eat the lentils that they serve, and you don't want to fight it then, right? So fight it now.
Yeah, and this is maybe also something that we just culturally need to say these days, sadly, which is just that if you're not shamed by an interaction like that as a parent, you should be, right? You should be ashamed if your kids show up to your pastor's house or your grandmother's house or whatever, and they say, I don't want to eat this, and they just won't eat it. And you have to bring other food that the people who are hosting you have not prepared for them to eat. That's terrible. That's shameful. And you should recognize, like, you're responsible for that. You're responsible for making sure that your kids don't act that way. So that's just key. One thing that we picked up from someone along the way, I can't remember who, is when you have those kinds of battles with your kids, like, you know, so-and-so doesn't love lentil soup or whatever it is, try to plan the meals and help your wife think about planning the meals in such a way that those things aren't falling back to back for two or three nights in a row, where, you know, this kid struggles with lentil soup, but they love pizza. Maybe plan the lentil soup and then pizza right after that in the kind of meal prep. And obviously you're not going to hit home runs on that every time. And also, a toddler can just decide they don't like pizza one day, and that sometimes just happens. And for a day out of their life, they decide they don't like pizza. That's kind of crazy. And I think you can help them oftentimes see that that's a little crazy, but it might happen. They might just not be hungry or whatever. And that's another thing, discerning between I don't like this and I'm not hungry right now. Like, I don't want to eat more. Sometimes kids will say, at least our kids have said sometimes, I don't like this. But what they mean is, I'm not hungry. I'm full. I don't want to eat anymore. And you have to be able to kind of discern that with your own kids.
That's why our go-to mode is, you don't have to eat anything on this table, but you don't get anything else. right. So no, you don't have to eat the lentil soup. You just don't get anything else until you do. And that ferrets out whether they're hungry or not. Like, because if they're actually hungry, like really hungry, they'll eat the lentil soup and they'll figure it out. And if they're not, great. I don't care. right. More for me. Right.
And one thing that helps with that too is just serving sizes, right? Like, if you know you're going to have dessert and you know that you're having a meal that it's harder for some of them to eat the whole thing or whatever, like, just be aware of that. Do your kids the kindness of recognizing this isn't the only time that they're going to eat today, much less ever. And so we don't have to give them all of the possible nutrition right now. Where we'll do that sometimes if we know we're going to have ice cream or something after, we'll give them less food than we would normally give. And if they want more food before they have dessert, they can always get more. Like you said, you eat what you've been given and you can always get more food, but you can't just not eat your food and then eat all the dessert with everybody. That's not going to work. And so just being judicious as a parent is a great kindness for our kids, and setting them up for success is really what we're saying. You want to set your kids up not to feel any need to fight those battles as much as possible, because they're going to fight them when it's totally irrational already. And whenever they have any kind of inciting incident, you know, it's going to make it that much harder to resist the temptation.
Yeah. We could go on and on about these practicals, and I think that'd be profitable. But for the sake of time, I think we should be landing the plane. I'll give just kind of one last shot, and then, you know, if you have any closing remarks, and then we can transition. But this is, we've alluded to this throughout. But the dinner, what's the line from Snoopy? Why can't mealtime be a joyous occasion? Right. The dinner time should be shot through with laughter and joy and even fun and hilarity. And if there's not, there ought to be times when people, when food is coming out of people's noses because they're laughing so hard, right? That ought to be true on occasion. And I would argue that it is often the dad's job to facilitate that. And so I will put on some rather comic displays, and I'll have recurring jokes or recurring themes, and I'll talk in funny voices or tell funny stories or try to draw that out as much as possible. Not as much as possible, because you also have to be self-controlled, and so we have to walk that line. But you're also teaching your kids that too at the dinner table. We always have to be in control of ourselves, right? And so that means we laugh and laugh and laugh, and then we be serious, right? And so I have to sometimes walk that line with the kids, like, yeah, we're laughing so hard, you know, lentil soup's coming out of your nose, and now we stop, and now we're going to attend to the scriptures, right? And we have to be able to do both. But sometimes the dad ought to be a clown and ought to just remind his children that life is very funny and that man is very funny. And often dads can be too fastidious and too, concerned with their own dignity. But no, God made very, very funny creatures, and those are humans. And we are hilarious in the sight of God, and we are hilarious in the sight of each other, and let us laugh for the sheer oddness of the thing and for the joy of living. And that should be shot. Your dinner should be shot through with that as well.
Yeah, I think we'll get to this idea when we talk about things like wrestling with your kids, when those conversations inevitably come up where you want to walk that line of teaching your kids manners and respect and these sorts of things, how to behave at a dinner table. It shouldn't be chaos. We've talked about that distinction between joy and chaos, and sometimes those look similarly, but they're not the same thing. And so you have to kind of shoot the gap, so to speak, between chaos and fastidiousness is a good word for it. This overly self-serious kind of attitude, this somber attitude around the dinner table, that shouldn't characterize it, but neither should chaos. And a barometer for that is, are you sometimes, not all the time, not every night, but are you sometimes having to get your kids to calm down and stop laughing so loud that you can't talk together, right? If that happens occasionally, it's probably a good sign. If it happens every night or multiple times throughout dinner, then you've got a discipline problem on your hands and there's no self-control. And so using that, there's not like a math equation you can plug that into maybe, but using that as a kind of barometer, like, do my kids laugh so much that it could get them in trouble sometimes? And can we get there and then curb that as we need to and they respond well to that correction? If so, that's great. And things are going well, at least in some manner of speaking. And, you know, there could always be more that you draw in and do and think about, you know, how to facilitate deeper and deeper joy and richness. But that's a great foundation to start with if you're there. I think the last thing that I would say would just be to reiterate that as the father and husband, you are setting the tone, which means you are interested in the covenant community. You are laser focused on them. And this is a hard thing for me. It's a hard thing for, I think, dads and husbands in general, is that you have to leave other things aside. And not just physically, like I'm not doing work at the table with my computer, sending emails or something, but I'm not spinning my wheels on things going on at work or at church or whatever that are not relevant to the moment at hand. And that's hard to do. When you're in a moment of crisis or something, that might be particularly hard, and there can be grace given for those kinds of moments. But something that Megan will sometimes do is I just get fixated on something in my mind and don't even realize that I'm staring into the abyss at the table for 20 seconds. And that's something that I need to check in myself, right? I need to be so interested in my wife and my kids around me that it's not easy for me to fall into that kind of state of just blind gazing through the table into the abyss and contemplating deep realities of life or whatever it is. It could be something silly that I'm just fixated on in my mind. We have to be willing to let those things go and recognize these people in front of me are more important, right? They're the most important people that God has given me to care for and to lead. And I'm leading them in something that will reverberate out into their lives and spill out into the rest of their lives. And if that means joy and laughter and peace, then it's going to spill out as joy and laughter and peace. And if that means dad staring off into the middle distance again and nobody has heard a word from him for 5 minutes, then that's going to spill out into other areas of life as well, that kind of tone and aroma.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So if you don't take anything else away, the dinner time gathering is perhaps the most potent thing you do as a family, and treat it accordingly. Oh, let's see. Book recommendations, sir. What do you got for us today?
Today, I am recommending Golic Wars. So I'm actually working through very slowly because it's not required reading, so to speak. The annotated landmark Golic Wars, which gives you a lot of kind of information that goes beyond just what Caesar writes. But not to bury the lead, Golic Wars is Caesar's campaigns in Gaul, modern-day France, and the surrounding regions. commanding his troops and leading these campaigns and conquests of the Gallic people, kind of subjecting them to Roman rule, quenching rebellions and things like that. And it's just a masterclass in a kind of tactical and strategic understanding of not only, I think, military prowess, but also human nature and how people work as societies, because he's not just dealing with the battles. He's talking about what's motivating these peoples to kick against Rome and what's motivating this other tribe of the Gauls to ally with us against them. And how can we maybe pressure them into being our allies long-term and kind of quenching this uprising? And what are the actual people like here who are commanders on the side of the Gauls? Like, so there's, you know, his dialogue or recounting his underlings' dialogues with the rulers who have been captured and the terms of peace and things like that that they come to. And it's just a really insightful book in terms of, you know, human nature, what goes into fighting a war, and how do you choose when to fight and when to surrender and when to run, when to ally with the tyrant versus when to fight to the bitter end, so to speak. And yeah, just very, very fun to read about for, I think, probably most men, at least, would enjoy it and would glean some wisdom from it.
I haven't read that one. I only know about it from the slightly less scholarly and the reverse side, namely Asterix and Obelix, which is a different account of Caesar's campaigns in Gaul. But if you haven't attended to that, you're looking at me blankly. You don't know Asterix and Obelix? Graphic novels? Oh, man. You have some joyful hours in front of you, my friend. Asterix and Obelix. Yep, you should definitely read those in pair with the Gallic Wars. Yeah, definitely. My recommendation today is very, very different, but pertains directly to Around the Dinner Table. And that is one that I think I've mentioned before. But this is the poetry of A.A. Milne, specifically the volumes When We Were Very Young and But Now We Are Six, which is a humorous verse of a variety of different types and genres, and it's all wonderful. So one thing we didn't talk about, but we'll probably talk about later, is I'm a big proponent of giving poetry to your children. And if you don't know where to start, start with When We Were Very Young and But Now We Are Six. It's as far as meter and rhyme scheme and like the quality of the verse, it's excellent. But the subject matter is all things that are accessible to children. It's not about Winnie the Pooh at all, except for very few exceptions. But wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. The King's Breakfast, Bad Sir Brian Botany. Binkers, of course. So many wonderful, wonderful poems. A. Milne, When We Were Very Young and But Now We Are Six.
That's great. On your recommendation, I actually got that from the library a couple of weeks ago, so we still have it. And I've read some of them at dinner. It's a lot of fun. The kids love it. They just chortle and chortle and chortle on some of those. They think it's hilarious, which is always, again, something joyful to bring into the dinner tables. Giving your kids, when you don't have ideas or you're feeling like things are going a little stale, look for something silly like that to share with them. Something fun, read it together, get them laughing, get them talking about it, and yeah, just enjoy it. Enjoy it with low stakes, right? In one sense, it's, like you said, the most potent thing you do, incredibly serious, incredibly important, but on the other hand, it's very relaxed and very natural, very joyful.
You do it every day. If one doesn't go well, you get another shot tomorrow.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed the show. If you want to follow the Substack that we are dutifully neglecting, you can see a link to the Substack in the description below. You can also see a link to Shane Caver's music. So we want to say thank you to Shane for the use of the theme music for our show. And we also want to say a big thank you to ETC Media. They have been editing our podcast now for a little while and have really helped us to keep the show going. So thank you to them. Jed Hicks and everyone over there have been doing great work. And with that, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty. That's right. When I'm having fun, you're having fun. Think about how bad it is right now. Imagine if I wasn't having fun.